This is Talk Back Gardening with Deb Tribe and Sophie Thompson.
On 891 ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
Good morning and welcome to Talk Back Gardening. Good morning, Sophie.
Good morning, Deb. Good morning, listeners. Merry Christmas and hope you're enjoying the festive season.
Exactly right. It's a beautiful time to do some travelling, to do some gardening. If you've got a gardening question, please call in for Sophie on 1300 222 891. I've got some Gardening Australia magazines to give away a little bit later in the program. And we love your comments too on the text line, which is 0467 922 891. But a lot of people travel at this time of year as well, Sophie, and you know, you go and visit your friends and family. A lot of people can take a day or two of annual leave and have a nice stretch of time off between Christmas and New Year. But one thing that does not take any time off is fruit fly, and we've been pretty successful here in South Australia, haven't we, for quite a long time at keeping it at bay. But it's always good to be reminded, I think, what we need to do to make sure that we protect our $1.3 billion horticulture industry. So, Sophie, we've invited Jason Size, General Manager of the Fruit Fly Response with PIRZA, to join us this morning. Good morning, Jason.
Good morning.
Good to have you with us this morning. And it is a time where lots of people are in their cars visiting people, and you don't want fruit flies hitching a ride, do you?
No, absolutely not. Look, this time of the year, there's, you know, there's lots of opportunities for fruit fly to still move, especially if you're in an outbreak area. So it's just a timely reminder, if you're coming into the Riverland, you know, there's no fruits allowed in the Riverland, even with a receipt. So just be careful. Otherwise, you know, you could risk a fine.
So one of the things that people... particularly if you've got a family, people have packed their car with produce because they're thinking, well, it's going to be cheaper if I take what I've got from home. You know, they're allowed to take anything that's cooked in terms of fruit, but just not anything that's fresh.
Absolutely. So when we're looking at fruit movement, we want to make sure any chances of, you know, larvae or maggots, for a better term, is in the fruit is actually destroyed. So, you know, cooked, preserved, dried, those sort of things are a good way to actually move the fruit, but especially not fresh fruit, because, you know, obviously there's a risk there.
Absolutely. And can we just clarify, is it any fruit or just certain types of fruit?
So it's certain types of fruit that fruit fly love to lay their eggs in. So, you know, you go onto the PIRZA fruit fly website and you'll see the range of fruit. So it's things like your soft fruits, like your stone fruits, your apricots, your peaches, your strawberries, those sort of things. So just be mindful of those. But there's plenty of other options out there that you can move. So, you know, your watermelons, your rock melons, your pineapples. So they're good choices to take.
Okay, because often I know, you know, having had a tribe of kids, and the last thing you want to do is stop halfway there. You try and take everything you need with you. So going over that again, watermelon, rock melon, pineapple. You know, what about things like passion fruit?
So unfortunately, passion fruit is probably one of those ones that are in the host fruit list as well. So just be careful on that. So again, have a look at the Fruit Fly website and you'll see those fruits that you're not allowed to take.
Okay, and what about, so one thing is travelling around the state, but the other thing is many people have fruit trees in their yard that are fruiting at the moment or will be over the next couple of months. Just remind us, you know, what people should be looking for, what they should be doing with fruit that falls on the ground.
So look for fruit that might have holes in it, especially if the fruit is starting to rot and drop. You know, obviously, you know, if you're leaving the fruit too long on the tree, they're going to drop anyway. But if they still look relatively green, but you're seeing them start to drop, or you can see the odd pinprick, you know, there's a good tagline that we have: pick, check, collect and cool. So, you know, pick the fruit, check the fruit for any holes or any markings, you know, collect it off the ground. And if you find anything which is suspicious, call it into our hotline, 1300 666 010.
So with people in their backyards, are there fruit fly outbreaks anywhere around the metropolitan area at the moment?
So we do have still the Glynde outbreak. So last year we had Salisbury North and the Glynde outbreak area. We've actually released the Salisbury North, so that's pretty well free to move around with your fruit. But if you're in the Glynde outbreak area, so, you know, that north, to the north east of North Adelaide, and then a 15-kilometre radius from that is what we call our suspension zone. So you've got to be careful, especially your homegrown fruit. Do not move that homegrown fruit. Look at doing other things with that fruit, such as you mentioned before, cooking it.
Well, we have proven eradication is possible, but you just don't want to have to go through that task, because I think the fruit fly has been eradicated in Swan Reach, Ceduna, and now you're saying also Salisbury North.
Correct.
Which is fantastic. So you have released how many now sterile fruit flies?
So in total over the last 5 years, over 4 billion fruit flies. So obviously a lot of those fruit flies, sterile fruit flies we've released. So a lot of those steriles are going to the Riverland, because we've got a few outbreaks in the Riverland at the moment, but we've released quite a few million in the metro area as well. You know, that's part of one of our eradication tools that we use. So sterile flies just outnumber any wild flies that might be out there to finalize or complete the eradication.
But the whole point is we don't want to have the problem in the first place.
Absolutely.
Yeah, you really do need to make sure that you just don't take any of those soft fruits or bring them into our state at all. So the website where you can find out more details is fruitfly.sa.gov.au. If you see anything suspicious or you want some clarification, there is a 24-hour fruit fly hotline, and that number is 1300 666 010. I'll say it again, 1300 666 010. Well, Jason Size, let's hope that you don't have too much to do at the beginning of this year, and that people do realise that one piece of fruit is all you need to potentially damage a very important industry here in South Australia. So go to that site, have a good look before you travel, and particularly if you're away at the moment and you're travelling back into the state, have a look at that. On the text line, JE is asking, what about tomatoes, Jason?
Tomatoes is unfortunately a host fruit as well, so that's one of what we say you don't bring, because fruit fly love those soft fruits.
Oh, and it's interesting, because a lot of us think of tomato not as a fruit but as a vegetable, even though it's obviously a fruit.
Host fruiting, fruit and vegetables is what we sort of term the phrase, host fruit and vegetables. So obviously even your eggplants, your chilies are all host vegetables as well for fruit fly.
Oh, wow. I did not know that. So there you go. We talk about this a lot and you learn something every day. Are you fined if you bring it in?
Yes, it is. So, you know, if you're coming into the Riverland, so the Riverland's what we call a pest-free area. So, you know, sometimes there'll be random roadblocks out about as well. So if you're coming into that Riverland pest-free area and you're caught, you will be fined. But generally, if you're coming to South Australia from the eastern states, we have border controls or stations there as well, which they will not only confiscate the fruit, but potentially fine you as well.
Okay, now Clint on the text line says, PIRZA do a great job and I appreciate their efforts to get suburbs and farms fully fruit fly free. So there you go, getting a bit of appreciation for that.
Excellent. Good to hear.
All right, Jason. Well, look, thanks for the...
Jason goes, we've actually got a caller on the line with an interesting question. Can we go to that, Deb?
Yes, we've got Greg from Morgan who lives on the river. Greg, good morning.
Good morning, everyone. Merry Christmas to all. Hey, I live in Morgan. Now, that's halfway between Yardunda and Wakeree. Now, on that road, on the Morgan-Yardunda road, there's a electric sign saying no fruit past this point, and there's bins there. Now, if I go to Kapunda and buy fruit and veg, I was always under the impression that we could keep the receipts, and if we got pulled over and questioned about it, we've got the receipt to show we bought it all in Kapunda or Wakeree. Now, like you said, with the receipts means we can't take fruit and veg either way. So how do we in Morgan and the surrounding areas be able to get fruit and veg without being fined?
So there are stores in places like Murray Bridge, specific stores which are listed on our website where you can actually buy fruit and you're allowed to bring that fruit in, but it's very restricted.
Murray Bridge is an hour and a half south of Morgan.
I understand that as well. It's just unfortunate, you know, because we're not allowed, even by our national rules, to actually move fruit in or out of that pest-free area.
But that's what I'm asking. Like, okay, so in other words, anyone that lives in Morgan can't take any so-called fruit fly fruit into Morgan. At Salt Not- Portland. Morgan's on the river. You know, it's a town. So, yeah, it's so in other words, basically, yeah, PERS is telling us we can't have fruit and veg.
Well,
we can't
no,
buy it and bring it in.
You can buy it from within the outbreak areas from a store. So if you're in the pest-free area, you can buy it from a store within that pest-free area.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying. If we go to Wakeree, between Wakeree and Morgan, which is 45 Ks, halfway, there's a sign saying no fruit fly. And the same between Yudunda and Morgan, there's a sign saying no fruit past this point.
Yep,
and
so the sign going...
This is not just for me. This is, we've got but Morgan's not a fruit-growing area.
So no, but you are within the pest-free area, so you can go into Wakeree to buy that fruit.
That's what I was initially asking. But, okay, if we get pulled up coming back to Wakeree after we go past that sign, are we able to show the receipts that we bought the fruit from Wakeree or Kapunda and not get fined?
From Wakeree, yes, you can. If you're coming from Wakeree going to Morgan, if you've got the receipt, that's fine.
Greg, I hope that answers your question. But, yeah, it's an interesting area for you to live in, given the restrictions that there are. This texter says, go to the PERSA website and challenge yourself to find the fruit fly information. Will you give us fruit fly website to visit? No wonder the public are having trouble getting a handle on this. No mention of the Glinda outbreak that extends to the Adelaide Hills. Well, we have just, you did mention that earlier, Jason. But I just typed into my search engine, PERSA fruit fly, and it took me straight to the information. It's got links, travelling to SA, restricted fruit and vegetables, find a quarantine bin, and general information. So that's probably what I would recommend. But that's some feedback for you, Jason, to take back. And another texter asks, do grapes harbour fruit fly?
So grapes are a potential host for fruit fly as well. They're what we call probably a less preferred host, but they're still a host fruit.
Okay, and finally this texter asks, if you report fruit flies, are you fined?
No, absolutely not. And we actually encourage people to call in if they find something suspicious so we can check it out, because the last thing we want is something to go unnoticed so we can't respond to.
Before we let you go, Sophie, did you have anything you wanted to ask Jason?
No, I think that's great. We've had lots of information, and I think anyone that's planning a trip up the Riverland and is going to take any produce should get onto that PERSA website.
Yeah, good idea. Jason Size, thank you very much for joining us this morning, and Happy New Year to yourself and everybody at PERSA.
Thank you. Happy New Year.
Thank you. Jason Size is General Manager of the Fruit Fly Response with PERSA, Primary Industries and Regions. So just put Fruit Fly PERSA into your search engine and it should bring you all of the information that you need. We're jumping into Talkback Gardening calls in just a moment. 1-300-222-891 is the number.
This is Talkback Gardening with Deb Tribe and Sophie Thompson.
On 891 ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
Let's head to beautiful Broken Hill. Helen has got a question about honeysuckle. Hi, Helen.
I have a honeysuckle that is growing along a fence and it's absolutely glorious, but it is becoming quite thick and heavy. And to my eye, I feel that it needs to be cut back. There's also a lot of dead stuff under the new growth that I think could do with a cleaning out. But I would like to know, when is the optimal time to do that?
It's certainly not now. And one of the things, I love honeysuckle, but it does have that habit that it runs up and then it balls at the top. So it does get heavy at the top, and where it shades underneath, it becomes daggy and has no foliage. That's the nature of the beast. But if you want to prune it, I would wait until autumn, until not only has the season changed, but possibly we've had autumn rains. Now, last year, autumn rains were quite late, so then I'd probably go around in April and trim it and give it a really good water. And then it will come back and it should have time enough to get flowers back on by spring going into summer. If you wait until winter, spring, it's going to be too late and you might miss the flowers. But pruning it when the weather, you know, when the weather changes, if you prune it now, it's probably not going to like it and you might get some dieback. But understand it will always do that. You know, in a way, honeysuckle is great for covering something that you don't need to look tidy all the way to the bottom, you know, an old outhouse or a, you know, something or other where it can scramble and do its thing and doesn't need to be managed.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Greatly appreciated. I don't know when we will get our rains, but
I know.
I'll certainly leave it to the cooler months.
Yeah, absolutely, Helen. And when you give it a prune and, you know, if the rain hasn't come, water it. Give it a good feed as well.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Sophie. Have a great
All
day.
All the best. You too,
Thank
Helen.
You. Bye.
Thanks, Helen. Anne has called from Renmark. Now, Anne, you've inherited some rhubarb. Good morning.
Hello. It's in a pot. Do we plant it out now or do we have to wait till it's a bit cooler?
Okay, so rhubarb is one of the few productive plants that will grow really well in semi-shade. As a matter of fact, it might even be better in semi-shade in a hot climate than in baking full sun. So if you've got a spot where perhaps it gets the morning sun, not the afternoon sun, you know, maybe it's on the eastern side of a fruit tree or something like that, you could have a go at planting it out now. Now, if you've only got full sun, I would definitely wait until the weather cools, until autumn, to plant it out. So ultimately it depends on, you know, what your position is. Rhubarb does appreciate good soil. So you might say, well, look, it's going to have to go in full sun. Why don't you start adding some compost and stuff where it's going to be planted so you can be working on the position and then plant it out when it gets cooler.
Right, so it's all right in semi-shade.
Well, you know, morning sun, afternoon shade is fine. Now, bear in mind, rhubarb has big leaves. So anything with big leaves means theoretically they can lose a lot of moisture through their leaves. So that's why it's quite good where it only gets the morning sun. And, you know, I wouldn't put it under necessarily a gum tree because that's going to keep the ground really dry. But something like a deciduous fruit tree would be perfect to be under the eastern side of it.
Right. What about the flowers on it?
The flower spikes I would just keep cutting off. They'll want to do that, so you just come along and cut them off.
So they're not used to anyone?
No. And if anything, it's going to take energy away from the crown. Now, the other thing I'm going to tell you might want to hear is that you can't actually pick rhubarb for a couple of years once you've planted it because we need it to put its energy into developing a good crown. So rhubarb, asparagus, those sort of perennial vegetables, once we plant them, we typically don't harvest them for 2 years. So, which is, and the reason why is we need all the energy that it's producing from its leaves to go into developing a good crown. And then, you know, then you can harvest in a couple of years' time. So if you're thinking of rhubarb and apple crumble, it might be a little while. You might still have to buy a bit of rhubarb in the meantime.
Right. Thank you very much for that.
All the best.
Thanks, Anne, for calling in on 1300 222 891. On the text line, Clint says, on a bike ride to McLaren Vale and can report the thistles clustered along the river lines are looking purply splendid. These are the variety that bring us the drifts of white balls I know as Father Christmases, sweet holiday childhood memories around the creeks of the Mid-North, to weed or not to weed? That is the question from Clint.
Oh, well, it would be definitely to weed if you could. Interesting, isn't it? You know, there are lots of weeds that, okay, you know, they can look pretty and you can have childhood memories, but ideally if you can get them before they set seed, you know, get rid of their flower spikes before they set seed, that would be fantastic. I'm sure around that area there are lots of amazing environmental greening groups. And also the council does a good job. So whether they're actually onto it, interesting.
An interesting question and an observation. Thank you, Clint. Maureen is in Moana with an ant problem. Hello, Maureen.
Oh, hi, Deb and Sophie. Good morning. Yes, I've got a front garden that's infested with ants, and they're so annoying because when I'm in there trying to weed and pick flowers, they're little ones, they come and bite. So I eventually sort of have to get out and give up.
Okay. So
I've tried the ant powder, but I did buy some borax to mix up a syrup with sugar, but then I got a bit worried it might be very toxic, so I haven't used that yet.
Okay, so first off, if we understand, and, you know, I do get ants. I live in a place that's very dry, and ants basically like dry soil. So if you want to move ants on, it's to make sure that your soil is hydrated. So ants love dry soil. So, you know, if we're not watering and say we've got a native garden, that's going to be where they want to be. But if you have a garden that has got lots of organic matter in it and it's mulched well and it gets watered occasionally and it's keeping that soil moist, they won't like it as much. They'll move elsewhere. So from what you're saying, I would say that the soil in your front yard is dry and not moist. Is that right, Maureen?
That's right. It's rubbish.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a garden we've had for 4 years when we bought the house, and it has got natives in it, and you're right, it doesn't get watered very often.
No.
But,
no. So basically it's telling you, it's dry. So either you say, well, look, part of this area I'm going to leave and I'm not going to water, or, I'm not going to water often, but part of it I'm going to water more. So if you water more, the ants will not want to live there. They need dry soil.
Right.
So it's all about the soil ultimately. And, ants are incredible. I do admit that I want to learn more about ants so I can appreciate them because, no one likes to be bitten. And I know all these creatures have a purpose. They have they're amazing workers. I've got some nests in my orchard, and when they are reporting that there's going to be a thunderstorm, I watch them build a moat basically around, a wall around their nest so that they don't get flooded out. I mean, they're incredible creatures. So if you can live with them, great. If you can't, maybe you just need to water more and use soil. If your soil is non-wetting, which means you seem to put water on and it just doesn't work, you need to get hold of soil wetters. Now, there's lots of different sorts. There are liquid soil wetters. Most of them are based on petrol or plastic, so I'm not so much a fan of them. There's a couple that are organic-based. There's one called Eco Hydrate, if you can find it. Otherwise, you can even get the powdered soil wetters. If you can find one that's based on bentonite, which is clay, and you sprinkle that around, that will help to hold moisture in the soil and prevent the soil from getting hydrophobic and dry.
Okay, lovely.
All the best with that.
I'll give that a go. Thanks, Sophie.
Thanks, Maureen, for calling in on 1300 222 891. Hearing your conversation and advice on rhubarb, Christopher sent a text through saying, all that work for rhubarb, just buy it at the supermarket. But, we know how great things are when you grow them in your own garden. And our new Saturday producer, Taylor, has been inspired after working with you and has set up a balcony veggie patch, including strawberries, tomatoes, squash, peas, spring onion and herbs. And as you say, Sophie, any space is space
Absolutely.
That can be productive.
I loved seeing that photo from Taylor. So thanks, Taylor. That's beautiful.
That is brilliant. I hope you get to enjoy the fruits of your labour in that regard. Sue from Mount Barker is on the line. Now, Sue, you've got a ginger lily. What's your question for Soph?
Well, it's gone up to the heavens. I've got it parked under. I've got it planted underneath the carport, and it would have to be 10 feet high. And I keep getting flowers, which is probably the first year that I've had flowers from it after it's been planted for about four.
Mm-hmm.
But do I cut the stalks back to the beginning when they've flowered, or do I just leave it go? It's massive.
Yeah, they are, and they're beautiful. Is this the creamy lemon one that has that beautiful sweet perfume?
It doesn't seem to have perfume, but the flowers are quite a deep they go from a lemony colour on the frilled edge into a deeper yellow, and then it's got this red, crimsony vein in it.
Yeah, beautiful. So the ginger lilies,
magnificent.
You can actually just let them be. When they're finished flowering, just let them be. But at the end of autumn, I would come along and cut all the foliage off, okay? Because often by the end of the season, the foliage is looking a bit tatty. So if you cut the foliage off almost down to ground level, then you'll get new growth coming next spring. And by next summer when they're flowering, you'll have lovely fresh new growth. So I would cut them back, but I'd just leave them for the moment and cut them back in, you know, at the end of autumn going into winter.
Okay, lovely. Thank you. Because it's just overtaking this space. I don't know what to do with it.
Well, it may be the wrong plant in the wrong position, you know, if it is overtaking. They are a clump-forming plant and they're lovely under, you know, if you've got a big deciduous tree or something, put some under there, and their foliage is fantastic and it just gives you that tropical feel. So, they're a fabulous plant, Sue, but, you know, ultimately if it's too big in that position, maybe dig some up and put it elsewhere as well.
I've only got outside, and I don't think in Mount Barker it would do well.
No. It would need to be under some sort of tree protection to be outside.
Yeah. No, this is it. This is the only spot.
Good on you.
Okay, thank you kindly.
Thanks very much. Appreciate the call there, Sue. On the text line, another Sue says, I found a solution to rats, mice and possums in my veggie garden. I add Christmas lights to my gardens. On flashing is best. They never come back.
Which is interesting, isn't it?
And Jane from Coromandel Valley says, I have sprayed kale and clay on my apple tree to stop woolly aphids, which worked well. I also used the kale and clay on a plum tree and it stopped the possums from eating the leaves.
Interesting. Well, kale and clay is used for all sorts of things, from citrus gall wasp to preventing sunburn. So I love to hear another use for it. Good on you.
Yeah, which is fantastic. And quickly from Kylie, Tim and Pepper, they are saying Merry Christmas and happy festive season to you, Sophie, from sunny Toowoomba in Queensland, and hoping that your 2026 is fabulous at the new house.
Oh, thank you very much, guys. Lovely that we have listeners from all over Australia.
Isn't it fantastic? So Sophie is here for you. So you can call in now on 1300 222 891. We like your comments as well on 0467 922 891. And we're going to be talking about how to prepare your garden when you're going away for a few days at this time of year, which many people are doing.
This is Talk Back Gardening with Deb Tribe and Sophie Thompson.
On 891, ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
Good morning and welcome to Talk Back Gardening. Good morning, Sophie.
Good morning, Deb, and good morning, listeners.
Lovely to have you here in these days between Christmas and New Year answering questions. And I've got three ABC gardening magazines to give away today just to mark the new year, two by phone, one by text. If you'd like to get ready for the text one, don't send it yet, though, please. Put your full name and postal address. And when I ask, the text line is 0467 922 891. We love your comments on that as well. And the phone line to speak to Sophie is 1300 222 891. Sophie, we've got quite a few callers, but we are going to talk about how to prepare your garden for going away, because it's really important information. So we will certainly get onto that very shortly. But let's go first to Dorothy in Balhanna. And Dorothy, you've got a tree losing some leaves. What sort of tree is it?
Good morning. It's a liquid amber, and it was beautiful up till spring. And when the new leaves came, they're just on the end of the branches. They're not all the way up the branches like, you know, they normally are. So I don't know what I should be doing. I did prune a few branches and they seem to have branched out down the branch. Burst out down the branches. but I don't know whether I should cut further into the tree.
I can see the photo of it. So there's two things that it could be. One is just a lack of water. You know, bear in mind that last year was the driest year on record, and so whether it just needs a bit more water. I can see that you've got something like box or something growing quite close to it at the base. How does it get watered?
Oh, it's only a sprinkler for the lawn and for the garden, just around.
Okay, so there's a lot of, you know, the lawn's taking some of that moisture, the box is taking some of that moisture. So if it was me, once a week, I would be getting a hose and just letting it trickle on the tree and doing that for several hours and seeing if that's a solution. Now, the only other thing that it does occur to me, have you got possums in the area, Dorothy?
We have, but it's quite a way away from the where the possums go across the roof of but it's away from that.
Okay, because possums can love to crawl up trees and eat foliage, and they often can't get to the right end of the branches because they don't hold their weight, so they tend to eat the foliage more, you know, closer to the trunk. So if you don't think it's a possum issue, I would then just be giving it extra water and just letting the water dribble on the trees. I'm currently trying to establish some trees in amongst garden area, and while I'm watering the garden area, I'm also making sure the trees just get a slow soak for a couple of hours once a week to try and get their roots down deeper. Because it's a relatively young tree, you know, it's probably under 5 years old, is it?
Oh, it's 10 years, but it's a smaller version. It's supposed to be a narrow version of it.
Okay, beautiful. Well, look, I would simply try giving it extra water. I certainly wouldn't give up. And, you know, as always, if you've got some seaweed-based plant tonic, it certainly doesn't hurt to give it some of that. And just look at it, and if you see it responding to extra water being given, then you know you're on the right track.
Fine. Thank you very much, Sophie.
Thanks for calling.
All the best, Dorothy.
Yeah, thank you. 1-300-222-891. Just a couple of bouquets on the text line, Sophie. One to Perza, who we spoke to earlier about fruit fly. Jim says, I live on average in Tailem Bend and was loaded with box thorn. Perza came and sprayed all free of charge, so a big thank you to them. And Joy is sending a big thank you to you, Sophie. What a wonderful, vibrant voice to hear every Saturday on the airways. What an inspiration to us gardeners. Thanks for telling us not to use glyphosate and other chemicals in our gardens. Well done. Always a new way to garden without chemicals. Thank you, Joy. That's lovely to hear. Now, Julie in Selix, you want a field of cyclamen bulbs. Good morning.
Good morning. Yes, a number of years ago I went to Open Gardens in Avondale in Rhynie, and
oh,
I bought heaps of bulbs for my cottage garden, but I noticed that she had them planted out in fields. So this year in May, when they were selling cyclamens through Bunnings, heaps of them, and some weren't looking too good, so they sold them out cheap. So I went backwards and forwards, and I think I've ended up with about 60 to 70. They're all sitting under my pergola at the moment in various stages of dying back. Now, I wanted to know whether I can plant them out now into the ground. If I can't do that, how do I look after them until they flower again next year?
Okay, so first off, Julie, where cyclamen will grow quite beautifully is under deciduous trees. Have you got any deciduous trees? Because that's what the beautiful garden Avondale has. She's got lots of deciduous trees. So have you trees?
Yes, I've got three ornamental pears in my cottage garden.
Okay, beautiful. So therefore, those cyclamen could grow quite well under there. Now, whether you'd plant them out now depends on whether that soil stays moist or not. So if it's you know, if it's a bit on the dry side, I'd be inclined to leave them until autumn when we get some showers and then plant them out. And they'll be beautiful. And so in the meantime, just water them daily. Don't worry about anything. Just, you know, keep them in a shade house or a similar position. Now, the one thing I will say about ornamental pears, when you go to dig them, don't go digging with a spade, okay, because if you cut a root, they can sucker. So you are better digging with a fork or a little trowel, you know, and just moseying around gently so you get less root damage, and then you'll have less of an issue with suckers. And if you do get a couple, then you can manage them. So
well, I've got a few now.
Well,
go and get rid of them.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, if you've got suckers, go out now, rip them off, never cut them off, because cutting them off simply gets them to bush up and become more vigorous. So you actually have to rip them off. And if you can get them when they're young, you can keep them under control. So, you know, if the garden area is really moist and it is quite shady, you could plant the cyclamen out now. But if it's a bit on the dry side, I'd tend to hold off till autumn.
Right. And you say to water them each day. I wasn't sure whether you had to water. I just thought you'd put them away and leave them.
Well, in the old days, the cyclamen were such that they used to get put on their side, right, just so the corm could dry out. Now the florist cyclamen have been bred, so most of them are evergreen. So most people simply just put them in their shade house and they get a bit of water with everything else. You know, you don't necessarily worry about fussing like we used to in the old days.
Right, so, don't overwater them, though. Just give them a sprinkle each day?
Well, just watch them. If they're wilting, they're dry, you know, and they need a bit more. The great thing about plants in pots is they have got good drainage. And so, you know, they're not going to get wet feet in a pot. And, you know, in the ground, the reason they do well in the ground under deciduous trees is because even if you water regularly, the trees tend to keep them sort of a bit on the dry side. So they're not going to get wet feet in the ground there either.
Oh, I see. Thank you. Thank you very much.
All the best with that.
Thank you.
Thanks, June. Appreciate the call. 1-300-222-891. Jim is from Engle Farm. Now, Jim, you would like to propagate kwandong.
Yes. Good morning, Deb and Sophie. I had the pleasure of meeting you, Deb, at David Bevan's last show, which was really good. I'd just like to ask, how do you propagate kwandong? So I have tried in the past without much success. I know they're parasites and I know they need a host plant. I've stuck a few seeds in the fridge, so I just want to know what I'm doing wrong.
Okay. So can I say, you know, I was recently up at the kwandong festival at Corn. And I heard one of the commercial growers from the eastern states, from Nil, actually talked about the fact that in the end, you know, he's decided they don't need just one host plant. They prefer about 10. And while he's tried all sorts of different ways, now he tends to walk around and just dig kwandong seeds into the ground on his bush block. And they come up when they're ready, which I think is interesting because, you know, there are so many other ways to propagate them. I'm going to give you a bit of homework. If you go to Gardening Australia website and you Google Gardening Australia plus kwandong plus the title is A Passion for Propagation, and it's with one of South Australia's native plants propagation specialists, a guy called Jeff Reed, and he actually talks about how he propagates kwandongs. And he soaks them the night before a hot day. So, you know, if it's going to be 40 degrees, he soaks them overnight in water. And then he puts the seeds on something really hot, like a sheet of black plastic or even a bit of corrugated iron. And the heat of the sun cracks them. And then he goes through this whole way he propagates them. So if you look up A Passion for Propagation, it's quite an interesting method of propagation, and Jeff gets great results. But I will tell you that, you know, when I heard this commercial grower speak, he threw all the rules out. He basically just goes around and you know, plonks seeds in the ground and they'll germinate when they're ready. But in a home garden situation, I think we want a bit more control.
Yeah, no, that sounds good, though. I'm off that that ilk as well. You know, I just, I haven't got a big garden. I live in a retirement village, but I've actually made it a native garden. And
beautiful.
I'm surprised at how many native bees in that hang around the garden when it's surrounded by concrete, you know?
Isn't that awesome? You know, if you plant it, they will come. Good on you, Jim. I love to hear that.
Cheers, Sophie.
Thanks, Jim. Lovely to hear from you. That is a great story, isn't it? You say it every week. You know, if you plant the right plants, you can bring all those fantastic things into your garden. It is Saturday Talkback Gardening with Sophie Thompson. Sophie, getting a few texts in relation to what to do when going away. Barbara says, I'd love some tips about pot plants when I'm away. The garden is irrigated. Can you give us some advice on how to prepare our gardens and our pot plants for when we are going away at this time of year?
Absolutely. Well, the first thing we're going to say is let's talk about the garden, then we'll get to pots. So, you know, if you have an automatic irrigation system, fantastic. But many people don't. So if you don't, the obvious thing is to ask someone, you know, a friend or a neighbour to water for you if your garden relies on someone turning the sprinklers on. Now, you know, the garden, if it's set up right, it should only need a good soak maybe once a week, twice a week if we're having a heat wave. So it's not a huge task. And you might even be able to, you know, rather than just get one person to do it and, you know, stretch the friendship, you might be able to ask two different people to do it on two different days. Or you could pay a neighbour's kid to come in and water, and that's another thing to do. There are battery-operated watering systems, solenoids, that go on taps. Can I say I bought one of them and it was way too complicated for me. It's still sitting there. It wasn't the cheap one and I didn't manage to get it working. I even got my kids onto it and we're going to have another go because I don't like to be defeated, but you can get, you know, battery operated. They work on a D battery and they work, you know, turning taps on or off. The best thing you can do to prep your garden though is to make sure that it's well hydrated before you go. Give it a good soak. Use seaweed-based plant tonics on everything. It increases plants' tolerance of heat and drought stress. And the other thing is, if you've got young plants that haven't been in that long, they're probably the most vulnerable and they're the ones that you could treat with an anti-transpirant spray. Now, it's not what you do on fruiting things, like you don't do it on your veggies, but it literally stops, it's like putting sunscreen on the plant and it's effective for 30 days. So that can be the difference between people, between things surviving and not. Now, when it comes to the veggie gardens need a lot of water and they really need to be watered daily. So, you know, the general garden, a good soak once a week, twice a week in hot weather, but veggie gardens can need to be watered daily if they're not wicking beds. So that's a bit tricky. And then pot plants also need to be watered daily in an ideal world. So what can you do about them? Well, you could either group them all together, move your pot plants to somewhere that's shady and cooler, and then they might survive only getting watered once a week or twice a week. The other thing you could even do, and this is not something I suggest all the time, this is a, you know, just to get you through, is to put a saucer of water under the plant. And that means the plant can actually wick water up from the bottom. And, you know, that, like the other thing I'd say, if someone helps you out with their with your garden while you're away, please make sure you reward them for that. You know, give them a plant or do the same for their garden. It's really important. And then the other thing we shouldn't forget is indoor plants. So, you know, generally indoor plants only need a good soak once a week. If you're going to be away for longer than that, maybe you can put them into a bathtub. Now, what you could do then is, say, put a towel down in the bath, make sure the towel is really wet, and the pot plants are actually, give them a good drink first and then put your plants on that, and then it's creating a little bit more humidity. Just thinking about, you know, pot plants are probably the most vulnerable. Veggie gardens are the most vulnerable too. Apart from that, just keep everything in optimal health with seaweed-based plant tonics before you go away.
So hello? I think I'm still here. I'm listening and I'm writing all your advice down.
Yeah, that was just like this onslaught. Sorry, Deb.
Oh my gosh,
we're going to run out of time. I need to get this out there.
It's all really great advice. And, you know, I'd never thought about my indoor plants. I always think about the outside. So I'm going to go home and find an old towel and put that into place when I'm going away for a few days. But, Sophie, we had a text earlier from Frosty who was saying he does use the irrigation sort of timer things and finds that they're very, very helpful. Mm-hmm. And Jenny said, last summer I covered our lily pilly hedge with green shade cloth. We were away for 3 weeks. When we took the shade cloth off, under it there was an infestation of bugs and the hedge was quite damaged. It's taken a long time to get it back into good condition. So I'm very concerned that she didn't have enough airflow or the shade cloth was on too long.
Well, you know, really, lily pillies should be able to grow in full sun, you know, ultimately. And if you could organise just, you know, most gardens should be able to survive. I'm not saying they're going to thrive on once a week watering.
Yeah.
So if you can organise that, you know, and I know there are all sorts of people that do house sitting, and often house sitting is actually not house sitting, it's garden sitting, really, if the truth be known. And the other thing I'm just going to put out there too, that if you love the birds, bees and butterflies, please don't forget about them when you go away, right? You know, I know my, you know, make sure that you put water into bird bowls, because if we have a hot spell and those birds are used to coming in for water and suddenly you neglect them, they're going to stress.
Very good advice, Sophie. Thank you so much. Now, if you haven't won anything from the ABC in the last month and you would like to win yourself an ABC Gardening magazine, then I've got two to give away on the phone line, 1-300-222-891, and one to give away on the text line. But if you're texting in on 0467-922-891, you'll need to have your full name and postal address. We're going to speak to Molly from Peterborough next.
This is Talk Back Gardening with Deb Tribe and Sophie Thompson.
On 891, ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
Now, Molly, in Peterborough, you've got an ornamental pear issue. Welcome.
Hi, good morning. How are you both?
Great.
Great. Sophie, I put an ornamental pear in probably about 10 years ago now. Because I realised that my garden didn't have any autumn colour. And I picked, I think it's a Mongolian, whatever it was. Anyway, it's done really, really well, which kind of surprised me for up here. But this last time when it started getting its leaves, it looked like it was going to be fine. But now it's, I don't know, only got about a third of the leaf cover that it would normally have. And there are definitely some dead small branches and that on it, and I'm just wondering what's going on.
How old is it?
About 10 years.
About 10 years. And so last year was the driest year on record.
Yeah.
So, and pears are quite long-lived and deep-rooted, but they may well have stressed a bit last year, which is carrying on to this year. So what I would be doing is I would be, you know, certainly picking up the water on it if you can. They should live for a really long time, but don't just give it like a sprinkling with the lawn. Make sure that it's getting its own watering out to the canopy for a longer period. Now, the other thing I would do, if it's sparsely leaved, you know, if the foliage is really sparse, my concern is it's going to get sunburn on the branches. If you can get hold of something called kaolin clay, and you can spray that on, so kaolin is K-A-O-L-I-N, that will actually stop any sunburn. We did quite a bit of this following the bushfires when plants got scorched, not necessarily burnt, but they lost all their leaves and suddenly, you know, trunks are exposed to sun that weren't used to sun. That might stop it getting sunburned, and I would certainly be using a seaweed-based plant tonic, and I'd just be focusing on increasing the water
This is an ornamental pear.
Our normal doesn't matter.
Our normal fruiting pears are fine. They're absolutely fine.
So basically it never got as many leaves as it should have this spring.
No, it's really, it didn't get the flowers either.
So seaweed-based plant tonics, pick up the water. Yep. No one used any herbicide, you know, or
No. We're absolutely okay. Herbicide free here. Yep.
Okay, great. So, you know, all I would do, and the leaves that are there, are they normal green or have they got a weird marking?
No, they look all right. Okay. It's just that, as I said, there's only about a third of what would normally be there.
Yeah.
It was really disappointing because I really honestly didn't think that, you know, because of our harsh conditions here, that it would necessarily do any good. And it's up until this year, it had been amazing.
Mm. Yeah, so basically up until the driest year on record, it was fine. So when we do have those dry years, giving things a bit extra water, even if we have to direct grey water or whatever we have to do to support them. But they are amazing trees and they are long-lived. So because of that longevity, you know, there are some trees that are not long-lived, but they are long-lived, so certainly worth persisting with, Molly.
Oh, thanks very much, Sophie. I really appreciate it.
All the best.
Thank you, Molly. Appreciate that. And congratulations to Rosalie from Northgate and Mark from Christie's Beach and Anne from Broken Hill, who have won the gardening magazines this morning. Mike is in Kingswood. Now, Mike, your neighbour's got a rose bush that's growing up and isn't looking so good. Good morning.
Thanks, Deb. And Sophie, hello. Good morning. Yes, my neighbour has the most magnificent standardised rose, which stands like about a 7 foot umbrella, and it looks magnificent in previous years, but this year about a quarter of it is not leafed and it looks like it's dying back. Is there anything we can do?
Okay, so this is a weeping standard rose that probably has a frame or something, does it?
It did, yes, it does have a frame, and my job is to keep it tied up to make sure it stays there.
Oh, good on you. Look, the bits that haven't leafed, I mean, you can get a bit of dieback in roses. My concern is the colour of the foliage that's there, is it normal colour and form or is it a little bit distorted and a bit stripy?
I think it's actually pretty good.
Is it? Okay. Okay. So if it's just, you know, if a branch has died back, I would simply cut that off. If it's dead, there's no point leaving it there. You know, what caused that is a bit hard to tell. If, you know, making sure that it's well watered and well fed. Roses are gross feeders. They, you know, they'll survive in our climate quite well, but they do best when they're nurtured with nutrients. The thing I was asking about with, you know, if the foliage was a bit stripy or distorted, is roses are also very sensitive to herbicide. Incredibly sensitive, and it causes this weird coloration in the growth and a weird form on the growth, and that's not good. But if the foliage looks good, all I'd do is feed it, you know, give it seaweed based plant tonic, cut off anything that's dead, and just keep an eye on it. They should live for a reasonably long time. If you can get photos, you know, look at the trunk, make sure it doesn't have any damage on the trunk, you know, make sure there's no sunburn where the bark is peeling away. And if you find any issues like that, you could possibly take some photos and send it on to the Rose Society, see if they, you know, have any thoughts. But, you know, it, just an odd bit of dieback, I wouldn't be too concerned.
But you think cut out the dieback and hopefully the rose will grow into those spaces?
Absolutely. If it's dead, there's no point in leaving it there. So, you know, the way you tell if something's dead or alive is you just scratch it. So with a pair of secateurs or your fingernail, just scratch. If there's green underneath, it's still capable of coming good. If it's not, and then you might reduce the length of it. But if it's brown, you might as well take it out.
Lovely. Thank you very much. We'll get on to that.
Thank you very much, Mike. Yeah, for calling in. And our last caller this morning is Philippa from Greenhill, I think. Hi, Philippa. What's your question, please?
Yeah, quick comment. 40 years ago, I took my parents for a cup of tea with Brian Powell at Corn. I couldn't help but think that when I heard about the Quandongs.
Absolutely.
Just to honour his legacy there. We've got an acre of an old dairy workers' cottage, which has weeds which have come up with a vengeance this year. I pulled a hell of a lot of bindweed off a fence between us and our neighbours, and I had to rush away and do something. And my darling husband put it in our compost bays with all of its seeds. Is it worth trying to get it out of the compost?
Oh, the bindweed is one weed that I don't think you can actually win against, and hand removal is the only way. But if you've put seeds in your compost, I would not be using that compost. So I know it's not a nice thing to say, but either you scrap the compost if it's been a while ago, or you actually go through. Okay, yeah. I'd go through and get the bindweed out. So for people that don't know, bindweed is a convolvulus, and it is so persistent. It has little white flowers. You know, it's almost impossible to kill with the use of herbicide. It's almost impossible to manage it. So I had it at my previous garden, and in the end, all I would do is basically to keep on hand removing it. So I'm sorry, Philippa. You know, I don't know how you can make it more fun. Maybe you can have afternoon tea by the compost bin.
Music and tea. I think what I'm going to do is take a length of plastic and bring it with me into the compost bay so I can try and wriggle that underneath so I don't shake the seeds into the depth of my knife.
Oh, my goodness, my goodness. I love that your husband was tidying up. Yeah, absolutely.
Have a good
All the best, Philippa.
Yeah.
Thank you. Same to you, Philippa. Thank you very much. Now, there's no Sunday Talkback Gardening through until the 11th of January, Sophie. So Saturday Talkback Gardening is it, but we will be continuing on in the new year. And Sophie, just to recap what you had to say about going away, a big deep water of our garden. Group your pots in a shadier spot if you can. Make sure your indoor plants are looked after in the bath with a towel. What have I missed in the recap?
Well, you could, if you say, I don't want to do that in my bath, you could do it in the laundry sink. The other thing is to treat everything with a seaweed-based plant tonic. And if you've got young plants, invest in a product which is an antitranspirant, because it's like sunscreen for babies.
That is wonderful. Well, Sophie Thompson, it's been a joy working with you in 2025. We'll be back next year, next week in 2026.
Absolutely. Happy gardening and happy new year.